One morning last October, Wisconsin was at the center of the political universe.
You'll hear argument first this morning in case 16-1161, Gill versus Whitford.
The U.S. Supreme Court was hearing arguments in Wisconsin's landmark redistricting case. At issue is whether the legislative district lines drawn by Wisconsin Republicans in 2011 were so partisan that they violated the constitutional rights of Democrats. The court's conservatives, like Chief Justice John Roberts, sounded skeptical of the statistical evidence.
It may be simply my educational background, but I can only describe as sociological gobbledygook.
But the court's liberals, like Justice Elena Kagan, seemed convinced that the court should act now.
This is not kind of hypothetical, airy-fairy, we guess and then we guess again. I mean, this is pretty scientific by this point.
It was such a big deal that pop culture icon Arnold Schwarzenegger was there to watch the show.
Because we are here today to ask the Supreme Court to fix something that the politicians would never do.
But despite the fanfare, 5 months later, nothing has changed. Wisconsin's case is still sitting at the Supreme Court. And University of California Irvine election law professor Rick Hassan says there are signs that it may be there for a while.
I think as every day goes by without a decision from the Supreme Court in the Gill case, it becomes less and less likely that there would be new maps being used for the 2018 elections.
Part of the reason is that Wisconsin's case now shares the spotlight. Other states have their own high-profile redistricting cases, and the U.S. Supreme Court even scheduled oral arguments for late March in a partisan gerrymandering lawsuit out of Maryland. Edward Foley is an election law professor at Ohio State University.
The U.S. Supreme Court wants to take a look at both cases because it wants to see, hey, do we want to adopt one theory or the other theory or both theories or neither theories? If they're going to figure this out, it just helps them to have more options on their table.
There are key differences in the cases. Wisconsin's challenges an entire state legislative map. Maryland's a single congressional district. Loyola Law School professor Justin Levitt says it could also be significant that in Wisconsin, Republicans did the gerrymandering. In Maryland, it was Democrats.
It provides a little bit of assurance for the public that when the court is making these rules, it's not doing so because of its own partisan preferences. If the court hands down a decision addressing a Republican gerrymander at the same time that it hands down a decision addressing a Democratic gerrymander.
Experts say these are not easy calls. The Supreme Court has never struck down a redistricting plan for being too partisan. Wisconsin Solicitor General Misha Saitlin, who defended Wisconsin's map in court, says now is not the time to start.
Politics permeates the decisions that legislatures make. And so courts getting involved in that area would be quite extraordinary and quite disruptive.
Given the rest of its calendar, the court may not rule on Wisconsin's map until late June. Ruth Greenwood is one of the lawyers who challenged Wisconsin's map. She says the June decision still allows plenty of time to draw fairer district lines for this November's election.
Justice delayed is justice denied. You know, all of our plaintiffs and all of the voters of Wisconsin have had too many elections with unconstitutional plans. We have to change it.
But on this point, experts not connected to Wisconsin's case say that's unlikely. Even if plaintiffs prevail, they say new district lines likely won't be drawn until the 2020 election cycle. That would mean that the legislative districts Republicans drew in 2011 will have stood for nearly a decade. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD sports and weather. The NBA, the Bucks beat Philadelphia 118-110. The Bulls had the night off. Tonight, the Bucks play the Pacers in Indiana, and the Bulls host Boston. Over in the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to Anaheim 6-3. They're off tonight. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, March 5th. It's kind of long and complicated. Here you go. A winter weather advisory in effect for Kenosha and Racine counties from 6 o'clock tonight until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. But that same advisory is in effect from 3 p.m. till 3 a.m. tomorrow for Walworth County. Cloudy and windy today. 50% chance of a rain-snow mix developing this afternoon. A high of 38 with winds up to 40 miles per hour. Then tonight we'll see a mix of drizzle and freezing drizzle, maybe accompanied by a stray thunderstorm around midnight, as well as snow and blowing snow, maybe 2 to 3 inches of accumulation overnight, with a low of 30 and winds up to 25 miles per hour. Right now, wind from the east-southeast at 15, 33 degrees Racine, 34 Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Just about quarter after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, featuring Easter candy, new apparel, and garden accessories in its recently remodeled gift shop. Open Monday through Friday from 9 until 6 and Saturday from 9 until 5. More information at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm sad to say that at least thus far, our scheduled guest for today, Dan Gaitan, has not yet appeared. He was scheduled to join us today to talk about work that he has done over the last several years on a very important topic, namely fraud in the hospice care industry. And the work that he has done is going to be featured in an episode airing tonight on CNBC's series American Greed, which, in its words, examines the dark side of the American dream when greed ends up compelling certain companies to engage in unfair or even illegal practices. And if Dan still makes it a little later in the hour, we will certainly make time to have a conversation with him. In the meantime, let's go with something else, a recently recorded interview that is about a book called The Age of Discovery. Again, you're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. We're spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show discussing what I think is potentially one of the most important and intriguing books I have read in a long time, titled Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. This is a book which explores the turbulence in which we are currently living and drawing some intriguing parallels between this period of the late 20th, early 21st century as related very closely, actually, to the Renaissance of 1450 to 1550. And it is a book which harkens some words of hope, but also points out some points of potential peril and calls for us to think very carefully about where our world is headed and some of the choices that we are collectively making in the midst of this dizzying array of new technologies that are altering so much of our daily lives and our understanding of the world and could potentially change our lives in years to come in even more drastic ways. This book has just been revised, released in paperback. It's a publication of Bloomsbury. And I'm very pleased to be able to speak with one of its co-authors, Chris Katarna, who is a two-time Governor's General medalist. He has his doctorate in politics from the University of Oxford, and his writing has appeared quite extensively. And again, this book is titled Age of Discovery. Chris Katarna, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it is my absolute pleasure, and thank you for that warm and generous introduction. I will try to live up to it.
It really is a fascinating book. You have words in the introduction that I think are very, very important. First of all, they touch on this title, Age of Discovery, and you write, in an age of discovery, there is no inevitable path of progress. And there are also really no passengers. We all need to learn how to pilot the ship. The assumption behind those words being that we tend to think in a time like this that is so turbulent and fast-moving that we can just sort of assume that we are collectively moving in a positive direction, and in a sense, what a lot of us can be content to do is just sort of hang on for dear life and sort of ride out the rapids. And you are saying we simply cannot afford to be complacent in that way. Tell us more.
Well, and you mentioned that we've just come out, my co-author Ian Golden and I, with the revised paperback edition. The hardback edition came out in early 2016. And at that time, we were making an argument that a lot of people, I think, had trouble accepting. And that argument was that, look, I mean, we are taking for granted everything that we have created, and we have constructed very narrow expectations for ourselves of what's going to happen next. And if you think back in 2016, I mean, here in the UK where I'm based, everyone said that Brexit was never going to happen. Over on your side of the Atlantic, everyone sort of looked at the candidacy of Donald Trump and said this person could never possibly become president of the United States. But back in 2016, we were already making the argument that we live in an extraordinary moment, a moment in which these unexpected events, like a Brexit, like a President Trump, these should be well within our range of what we expect might happen this year and the kind of time that we'll be living in. And then these events happened, so that, you know, today, now that we bring up the paperback edition, I actually think a lot more of the world has caught up with our argument that, you know, yes, we did look pretty narrowly at the world we had constructed and what might happen. We had looked at globalization, and we'd looked at digitization and the advent of social media, primarily through the lens of what are the benefits, what are the opportunities that are going to come out of this new world that we've discovered. Whereas today, you know, fast forward just a couple of years, you know, we are all of us every day, I think, alive a lot more to the risk, to the downside, to the underbelly of all the things that we've constructed. And so now, you know, ironically, what we need is some perspective, some big picture narrative that helps us to kind of step back from this storm and rediscover some confidence that, yes, we can navigate to a better new world that lies beyond it.
And in saying that we need perspective, you quote none other than Leonardo da Vinci, one of the great masters of the Renaissance. Explain what he had to say about perspective and its relevance to this current age in which we live.
You know, Leonardo da Vinci was many things. He was a polymath, and the Renaissance is an age for polymath. But on the subject of perspective, he said that perspective is the guide and the gateway. And it's very interesting to use history as a way to gain some depth on the present. And actually, when you think about it, I mean, that's what we need, right? We are so, present events are so in front of our face right now that it almost feels like we are just, you know, reeling from them, one headline after another, after another. And so I think intuitively we all know that we need to somehow step back and gain some perspective. That was certainly how Leonardo felt in his own time, where the printing press had suddenly emerged and was opening up all these new avenues of discovery, while at the same time it was empowering you know, populist prophets to shake the political and religious foundations of Europe. And the challenge, I think, that then and now we face is, well, you know, how on earth do we gain perspective on present events when they are so global, when they are everywhere and surround us and involve everything? And this is where I think history comes to save us. 500 years ago, Renaissance Europe looked back to classical Greece and Rome and said that, you know, look, we need to resurrect some of the virtues, some of the civility that allowed that civilization to flourish. And I think it's the same today that, you know, we can recognize that, you know, look, to see depth in space, we need two points of view. You know, we need a here and a there. That's why we have two eyes. And so to see depth in present events, we simply need two points in time. We need the present and we need the past. And then it's just about finding what is the right moment in the past that gives us the best lens on sort of making sense of present.
And you are suggesting that what we think of as the Renaissance is that period to which we should look in order to gain that perspective.
You know, What's remarkable, Greg, is if we can imagine a future, say 500 years in the future, and we look back on the history of our own time, sort of the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century, put our thumb on that page of humanity's history book, and then put another finger on the page of the history book, which was the Renaissance 500 years ago. You know, if you flip back and forth between those two pages, I imagine we'll see that they're virtually identical. I mean, the first page, the first sentence of our page in the history book today is certainly going to be about the advent of this new medium, the Internet, right? This digital medium, the very first time in history that our tools, our computers, are now able to talk to one another. It's completely transformed how we communicate, transforming our economies and politics and society. And, you know, the very first line of the page, the Renaissance page of the history book, is, of course, the advent of print, right? So they had Gutenberg and we have Zuckerberg. You know, line two of our page in the history book, I'm sure, will be new maps, globalization, right? How we've tangled together global capital and trade and people flows. And 500 years ago, of course, the second line of their page in the history books was also new maps, only for them it was the voyages of discovery, the voyages of Columbus and Magellan and Da Gama that likewise just transformed capital and trade flows and created enormous opportunities along the new ocean trade routes and created economic collapse along the old Silk Road. And so, you know, as we look through history, for where is the story, the analogy that best helps us to gain a global sense of what's at stake in the time we're living in now? And many thinkers have proposed their views. You know, are we living in a fourth industrial revolution, for example? But I'm convinced, and you know, my co-author and I spent a lot of time looking at this exact question, that in terms of the breadth and the depth of the transformation that we are underway right now, it's the Renaissance that should be our guiding light. Hmm.
We're speaking with Chris Skutana about his book, Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. He co-authored it with Ian Golden. Mr. Katana, one of the things I enjoyed in your book was a brief little section called Good Housekeeping, in which you, in your words, try to tidy up three kind of complicated issues. And in that portion of the book, in which you're really, for the most part, focusing on the Renaissance period, one of the things you say that I think is so important is that the term Renaissance is really, in a sense, too sweet, too positive a term to describe that period in our world's history. And I have to confess that now that I think back to the times when I have had to talk about the Renaissance in some of the music classes that I have taught, that I have tended to fall into that very same trap and have tended to focus almost exclusively on the groundbreaking discoveries that made life better for people in almost every respect, and have really neglected to also talk about, in a sense, the darker facets of the Renaissance, which made it also an incredibly frightening, disconcerting time in which to live.
Mm-hmm. I think that actually that's why the Renaissance is such a powerful metaphor for our own experience today. The Renaissance was a time of an extraordinary flourishing of genius, right? This was the time of Gutenberg and Michelangelo, Da Vinci, Machiavelli, Raphael, Copernicus, right? These people who coexisted and they co-created, you know, not just, you know, little additions to the human story, but whole paradigm shifts that put together, they shifted Western civilization from the medieval and into the early modern era. And, you know, that's the kind of enthusiasm that we had about our own time in, you know, not so long ago, say in the 1990s, when political scientist. I'm a political scientist, you know, and in my field you had prominent political scientists like Francis Fukuyama declaring the end of history because democracy has triumphed and there is no contest anymore about how do we order society and what the good life is. And we have these marvelous new technologies that are going to flip the human condition from scarcity to abundance. And isn't that going to be wonderful? But the other side of all of these transformations is, of course, the disruption, the risk, those who are left behind. We can't, if we're honest with ourselves about the human story, you know, we cannot talk about Gutenberg's printing press and all of the marvelous inventions in science that made possible without also talking about, say, the Protestant Reformation of Martin Luther, which, you know, not only broke the Catholic Church in Europe, but ignited a century of religious war. We can't talk about the voyages of discovery of Columbus and Da Gama and Magellan without also talking about the impact that European colonization had on the native populations of the Americas, without also talking about how the shifting of the global economic center of gravity, if you will, from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, devastated old economies in Italy and in the central of Europe and in Asia at the same time as it created new ones. And, of course, you know, today we've come to the same sober understanding. You know, globalization has caused tremendous shift in the locus of opportunity. And if we have the mobility to chase after those opportunities, then everything is wonderful. But, you know, many people in our society have frictions. We have children. We have elderly people to care for. That means we can't chase after the opportunities. We have what is our access to education? What is our access to health care so that we have the resources we need to participate in the society? Can we keep up with the soaring cost of housing in those places where economic opportunity exists? In addition to all of the social and political upheaval that is also unleashed by such rapid change that we are struggling to keep up with it. Our institutions are struggling, our legal systems, our political systems, our intuitions are struggling to keep up with it. So yeah, that is, I think, the quality of the moment that we are in. And hopefully thinking of the now as a renaissance helps us to recognize that all of this chaos that we're living through is actually more like a compass that points us to the things that we need to work on.
Hmm. The whole, I should say, part of your book spells out what occurred in the Renaissance in even more detail than we've talked about. Part of your book looks at the last several decades, really beginning in about 1990, and spells out some of the ways in which what we're living through right now is an intriguing parallel to the Renaissance. And part of your book is about what you characterize as a contest. The present age is a contest with very, very high stakes in terms of what we are going to choose for our path. You and your co-author spell out some ways in which you think the healthiest, most ultimately beneficial choices can be collectively made, and they include things like welcoming genius, daring to fail, and something called finding each of us finding our Florence. And you also call us to make new maps. I don't even know where to begin with the little time that remains, but I think it's especially intriguing for you to talk about what you mean by finding our Florence and by making new maps. Both of those points are especially important.
You know, what's interesting about Florence in the Renaissance, it was really a place that was unlike anywhere else in Europe. I mean, this is a place that was mostly literate at a time when most of Europe, you know, couldn't even sign their own names. This was a place that was eating food from sort of all over the world at a time when most people were living on gruel. And, you know, Florence produced more artistic genius and you mentioned your interest in Renaissance art, than all the rest of Europe combined. So something special was happening there. And if you look at what was happening, it had to do with diversity, it had to do with inclusion, and it had to do with an investment by the wealthy elite, in this case the Medici, to really underwrite the creative expression of that society. The moment we live in now is one where crossroads matter, and whatever our area of interest or passion, figuring out where is the crossroads in the world today where that passion thrives, and getting ourselves there is just as a matter of sort of personal life choice making, I think really critical to being at the center of whatever flourishing of genius is going to take place in the area that matters to us. Making new maps, I think, is the fundamental task that we all face. And it really is about recognizing that we navigate the world with a set of maps that is backward-looking, that is based on our experiences and what we've learned. And the faster that the world changes, the more that we need to try to become aware of what our maps are and change them, too, so that our thinking keeps up with our reality. The best story about this, of course, is Christopher Columbus, who famously set sail in search of Asia. He found America, of course, but he thought that he had found Asia. And the reason that he thought that was because he was navigating by an old map from the Bible that said that the world included Asia and Africa and Europe, and that was it. And because he had no way in his head to understand the idea of America, that's why America isn't named after Columbus, but after someone who 10 years later, Amerigo Vespucci, did figure out that we need to change our maps in order to make sense of these discoveries. And so when so many of us, I think, are struggling, how do we keep up with change? The first and most important, most fundamental step is, I think, to revise the maps that we navigate the world by.
I appreciated that early in the book you write, we don't know where we're headed, and so we let ourselves get pushed around, bullied even, by immediate crises and the anxieties they evoke. I appreciate how your very well-written and well-reasoned book is maybe one way to combat that sense of helplessness that many of us sort of feel trapped in the days in which we live. Is that part of the reason you wrote this book?
I think that's the major reason that my co-author Ian and I wrote this book, Greg. And you describe that sense of entrapment, sort of, the metaphor that we talk about is, of course, being in the center of this storm. And America is at the heart of this storm, right? Where risk and genius are flourishing most. Just like Florence was the heart of the first Renaissance, and also where the forces of that moment tried to tear society apart. American society today is being tested. The bonds holding us together are strained more than in any other place, but are also making plain and urgent to all of us how important the renewal of those bonds is. And so ultimately, the hope of creating a Renaissance narrative over the time we live in is to help us feel some hope and determination in the midst of this storm, that yes, if we can join in this contest, then we too can usher in the next age in human civilization.
The book again is Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance, just released by Bloomsbury in a revised paperback edition. Chris Katarna, congratulations on this really superb book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Greg. It was my pleasure, too.
And the time is 8:40. You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. We're going to spend this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with a woman by the name of Kristen Helms, who decided to make a very important decision when she became pregnant with her first child. namely to leave behind the only professional life she had ever known in corporate America. And it is a choice that, of course, confront all kinds of women, and different decisions can be made. And she's written a book about the decision that she made and about the steps she took to make her sort of the second phase of her life as happy and fulfilling as it could possibly be. Her book is called From Boardroom to Baby, A Roadmap for Career Women Transitioning to Stay-at-Home Moms. It's published by Career Press. And Kristen M. Helms, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad we can talk to you about this interesting book and about your story, which, of course, very much runs parallel with the stories of all kinds of different women across the country. I want you to begin by telling our listeners a little bit about what you outline in the very first chapter of the book, in which you spell out your own story, when beginning with when you were something of an entrepreneur at the tender age of 10.
Yes, when I was 10 years old, living in East Sacramento, I made my own business cards on my mother's electronic typewriter, and I passed them out to all my neighbors, and I sort of created a pet service or a dog walking service and babysitting service to all my neighbors. So I started my entrepreneurial side a little early, and, you know, that theme kind of always followed me throughout the rest of my life, just my drive for a good work ethic and always trying to succeed in everything you do. So it definitely laid the foundation for what was to come.
Right. So you tell us you essentially always had a job of one kind or another from the age of 14 to just before you turned 30. And that's when you became pregnant for the first time. You tell us being pregnant was not a surprise. This is something you and your husband wanted to have happen. I wonder, ahead of becoming pregnant, how much had you thought about the question of whether or not you would ultimately go back to work and so on? Had you taken the time to really explore that very much? The book sort of implies that perhaps you hadn't at least fully wrestled with what that was going to mean.
Absolutely. I think, you know, on paper and before I was actually pregnant, I always just thought, you know, I'm always going to keep building my career and I'm always going to be in the workforce. And so I just thought, you know, we'd add our first daughter and then I'd return to the workforce and keep, you know, building equity in myself, building my career. And it took me a little off guard that I had these other emotions and feelings that maybe that wasn't the only path for me right now. And so that's when I really started exploring, you know, after it was actually when I was on maternity leave that it really hit me that, you know, I think I'm going to veer off of my career course, at least for a period of time, and stay home with my daughter. So that those feelings did take me off guard in the beginning, definitely.
Right. I like how you describe how as you walked out of your job then to go on to maternity leave it was with no sense at all of certainty that you weren't coming back, but in fact, you never returned to that office or to that life. And of course, one of the things that meant then is that you needed to, in a sense, find a new source of self-worth and self-identity. You needed to be able to understand who you were and what life was all about, given this gigantic change.
Absolutely, and I think that's what took me off guard and takes a lot of women off guard who make that decision to leave their careers and stay home for a while, is we're so accustomed to receiving external reinforcements from jobs like, you know, raises and praise and pats on the back and just interaction with colleagues on a daily basis. So to then leave that and, you know, suddenly you're on the home front with a tiny baby, there's, you know, not much communication going on. You're not receiving, you know, your baby's not turning to you and saying, thanks for taking care of me today, or you really did a great job. You really have to then, you know, try to search for those same feelings of worth from within.
Right.
Internal strength, yeah.
You know, I think that's probably even more true now than it was, say, 20 years ago. And the reason I say that is because it seems as though the workplace in general has become much more attuned to assessment. And certainly in the world of higher education, which I'm also a part of, aside from the radio station here, that's very, very true. It feels like we're assessing everything all the time, and most of the time quite numerically. And so if that is a big part of the matrix against which you're working in the professional field, then suddenly you're at home with a baby and nobody's giving you an 8 or a 9 or a 10 and assessing your improvement in such and such. And I mean, suddenly all of that is away, and those feelings of accomplishing something, making progress, showing improvement, being worthwhile, that has to come from someplace else. It's not going to come from the sources it came from before.
Absolutely. I think you're exactly right that we, you know, and especially recently, it is such, you know, based on, you know, merit and, you know, advancing, and there's performance reviews, and there's, you know, there's different awards you can win. I don't know. There's just so much external reinforcement, and then to then be at home and not have that is definitely a change of pace, and you have no one to report to but yourself. Which was another just weird thing. You know, you don't have a boss who, you know, you're trying to impress, or you can say, like, look what I've accomplished this quarter. So it's striking how much power you have in your own hands as a stay-at-home mom. You know, just reporting to yourself and not being really held accountable for anything, you know, you can design this role however you like.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kristen Helms about her book called From Boardroom to Baby, A Roadmap for Career Women Transitioning to Stay-at-Home Moms. This book is largely about her own experience of leaving behind a professional life in corporate America to be a stay-at-home mom, and some of the wrenching changes that created in her own life. You write at one point, this book is intended as a compass for career women turned stay-at-home moms to help navigate that transition. Say a word about what you wish you had had when you made this transition. What would have made a difference to make that transition perhaps easier than it was for you?
Sure. You know, I think when you make that decision to stay home, you kind of have this rose-colored lens about how life's going to look at home with your baby, because you love your baby so deeply, or your children, you know, if they're older, and you just think, you know, I can't imagine going through any obstacles or hardships if I'm at home with my child. So I think, you know, it would have been so helpful if someone had just kind of warned me that you're going to go through some internal emotions. You know, of course it's going to be great to be with your baby every day, but you're also going to need to fill a kind of a void for your past career, like in your soul type of thing. So I think if someone just would have warned me, you know, all these kind of mixed emotions that come with it, and if I would have been more on the lookout for that, and just know that those feelings were actually normal. You know, I've talked to a lot of stay-at-home moms who have gone through all these same emotions, and they say, you know, I felt so bad feeling these ways when I was lucky enough to stay home with my child. So just knowing that the feelings are normal and that you kind of do go through a big transition leaving career to stay home, but that you can find your groove and find your rhythm from the home front. Mm.
One very important part of your book is where you help a woman and presumably their life partner as well together make that decision about whether or not to stay at home. And you present quite a plethora of questions that you think they should pose to themselves and answer as honestly as they can. Without outlining every single question, because there's quite a few, just give our listeners a sense of kind of the scope of what you want somebody in this position to be thinking about and the kind of questions they should be asking themselves.
Sure. So, you know, in one of the very first chapters, I outlined that you should really take into consideration three things, and it's circumstance, values, and self. So before I made the leap, we did, you know, do our due diligence and ask ourselves some questions surrounding circumstance. So, you know, we didn't have any family in town to help with childcare. We crunched the numbers, and we were able to live off of one income. Of course, we'd have to tighten, you know, in certain areas, but we could make that happen. So circumstance really just, you know, your realities and, you know, what does it look like on paper? And then values, you know, my husband and I were both actually raised by stay-at-home moms, so we did find value in that lifestyle. We kind of knew what it looked like from the other side of it as a child. We liked our mom home all the time. So we found value kind of in that lifestyle, what we thought it would be. Self, that's the thing that I didn't really know that I had to look at when I made the decision. And that's, you know, can you picture yourself as a stay-at-home mom? You know, are you the type of person, are you a type A personality who's very organized, or are you, a more career woman who, if you did leave that big part of yourself behind, maybe should you look at starting like a side business from home while you're home, or a project or a hobby, you know, something that's going to give you a little bit more life outside of motherhood. So I kind of, you know, go through, and I think when you look at the whole big picture, those things combined, your circumstances, your values, and then yourself, and you read through, I lead you through an exercise where there's a bunch of questions, but you read through all your answers, you kind of can start to see like a certain path kind of illuminating in which direction that you should maybe go towards.
Right. I really also appreciate the way in which you kind of sort out the way we can kind of look at what did that early life give to me? What did I enjoy about it and appreciate from it and take from it that I'm probably not going to get in this next phase, should I decide to leave that life behind and become a stay-at-home mom? For you, I think personally, for instance, it was, for instance, the sense of structure that one has when one works in corporate America. That is something that might not be present in this new life, or certainly not in the same way, or maybe it's a case of you need to try to make sure that you create as much structure as you can in this next phase, but it's not going to be just there on its own. I thought that was really intriguing, and I suspect that for every person, this kind of thing is going to play out a little bit differently.
Absolutely, and it will depend on, obviously, like personalities and what you need in order to thrive. I talk about that a lot, asking yourself, what do you need in order to thrive? And you're right, for me, I was used to structure. I was used to, you know, to-do lists and being able to check things off my list and big goals. So I sort of realized early on in my journey through stay-at-home motherhood that I had to kind of set up this role in that way in order for me to thrive. So, you know, it's funny, I would start checking in with myself, you know, instead of having, I called it meetings with the boss, you know, kind of with yourself, to kind of stepping back from the daily grit of, you know, raising tiny humans and thinking, you know, just evaluating like, okay, what can I pat myself on the back on? What have we done that's, you know, really great? Or what do I need to work on? But aligning everything, every aspect of my role, kind of mirroring how I was in the workforce. With a lot of structure.
I appreciated, too, how you realized for yourself that in your professional work, doing creative work was really, really important. And one can see how very easily that could be sort of left behind, very much left out of the equation altogether when one finds yourself as a really busy stay-at-home mom. I mean, and of course, in fact, there are opportunities, and especially if we're aware of it and try to create those opportunities to be creative, versus only realizing way after the fact that in being a stay-at-home mom, you ended up sort of leaving out something that was really important to you and not realizing it until you're looking back with regret. I suppose part of the point of this book is to try to think of those things ahead of time, and to try to create a stay-at-home mom experience that can include these things that are important to you but that might really easily get lost in the mix.
Absolutely. When I remember in the early days as a stay-at-home mom, my daughter, you know, when they're babies, they nap all the time. So all of a sudden you have a lot of downtime. And I remember she was napping one day, and I was wandering around the house. I went in and checked on her. She was still sleeping. And I just thought, I feel a little lost inside of my own home. Like, you know, the chores had been done. I didn't know what to do, and so I opened up my laptop, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to start writing down my feelings. started into a mommy blog, actually. And it was just I realize it now that was a creative outlet for me that I needed, and something that I, you know, the creative side of me in a marketing and PR position before becoming a stay-at-home mom, I really needed to exercise that creative side of me. And I think that, you know, motherhood lends itself to that, because in the early days, there are breaks when the kids nap, or, you know, in the evenings, you know, they go down to bed early. There are little pockets of time that you can find. And if it's, you know, if you're not creative, or maybe you like crafting, or maybe, you know, whatever it is that you need from your past career life, or that kind of fills your cup back up, you can find these pockets of time and express yourself and really in a really creative way.
Mm. I know that one facet of your own experience were a couple of things you needed to work on that you knew you weren't particularly good at, or these would be points of, let's say, weakness as a stay-at-home mom, and one of them was patience. You needed to work on patience. You needed to work on functioning with a little less control over everything. I'm just curious, how did you work on those particular things? And whatever people's weaknesses are, how would you suggest they work on those weaknesses?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest part of that is just identifying what it is first, right? So in my past career life, it actually worked to my advantage to be kind of less patient, because it was a very fast-paced marketing role. You know, I kind of kept projects moving. I didn't have a lot of patience or time for stuff, but we produced quality work. But patience was kind of, you know, it worked in my favor not to be super patient and relaxed. But then as a mom, we all know, you know, you need a lot of patience. And just as soon as you think you have it all figured out, then there's a growth spurt or development with your child, and then you have to refigure it all out. So just, you know, for patience, and now I have two toddlers, a 2- and a 4-year-old, so now I'm really channeling all the patience. But it's just, you know, you just constantly are learning, and I'm constantly just checking myself again and again. And just so I think that, you know, the biggest thing is just knowing your weaknesses and just keeping those in the forefront of your mind. So, you know, when you find yourself becoming, you know, less patient with your children, or, you know, getting a little annoyed at things, then you can be like, okay, I need to just take a breath, you know, kind of realize the bigger picture here, and then move forward.
When do you think somebody ideally should read this book? I mean, at what point in their life, in terms of before they're even pregnant, or while they're pregnant, or just before they have their baby, or just as they come home with the baby, when do you think would be an ideal time to read this book and explore some of the possibilities and suggestions outlined in it?
You know, I think there's a couple different answers, because I kind of made it in a way that it would touch a lot of different women at different journeys or at different points in the motherhood journey. So definitely this would be a great one if you're considering leaving your career to stay home, because it's sort of a what to expect when that happens. And then to the new mom who maybe is on maternity leave or has just left her career to stay home and is really fresh in those new feelings, fresh in that new transition, this would definitely resonate. And, you know, even seasoned mothers, I've had a few actually stay-at-home moms who have been stay-at-home moms for almost 10 years. And I just, you know, I'm getting some feedback from them saying, wow, thank you for saying these things out loud and like making this more normal to talk about, because they had been feeling all these kind of obstacles and dealing with it sort of silently. And now these are conversations that are being had and saying, you know, it's okay to have these feelings, but here's how to work through them, and here's how to build a life that's thriving at home.
Hmm. The book, again, is From Boardroom to Baby, A Roadmap for Career Women Transitioning to Stay-at-Home Moms, published by Career Press, the author Kristen M. Helms. Kristen Helms, thank you so much for writing this book and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We are approaching